This week's show with Ana Luisa Catalano is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America. And here's a word from EGA President Lee Peacock.
Hi, this is Lee Peacock, President of the Embroiderers Guild of America, and I would like to extend an invitation to you to attend the 2025 National Seminar to be held in Dallas, Texas. The theme this year will be a needlework fair, and by royal proclamation, Her Royal Majesty has prepared great merriment and festive activities for thy coming pilgrimage to the needlework fair, November the 12th through the 16th, 2025. Fair travelers will journey to the land of Dallas in the mighty kingdom of Texas for 5 days of amazing tutelage, treasure enhancement, and heartfelt camaraderie. Talented kings and queens of the needle from hither and yon will offer skilled artistry for thy learning enjoyment. Pop-up shop merchants from around thy kingdom shall submit their wares for thy pleasure. Artisans and craftsmen will inspire and delight thee through exhibition of thine fine arts. All my lords and ladies are heartily invited. Offering for guild masters and apprentices shall abound, with choices ranging from intensive 5-day classes to mini classes. Stitching time and night owl sessions will provide a retreat setting for ye wishing to ply the needle independently. Thou shalt find new for 2025 thy Sampler University, an all-inclusive 2-day sampler extravaganza featuring 2 popular artisans, 2 beautiful offerings, and other delights for thy fair participants. All court ladies and lords will discover delights for thy pleasure and edification. If you would like more information about the National Seminar, please go to egausa.org.
Thanks to EGA and Lee Peacock for sponsoring this show, and now our conversation with Ana Luisa Catalano. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artist this week, Ana Luisa Catalano. Ana, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay. All right. Article on the EGA website that Beth sent to me. And I try not to go right, if somebody does an article on EGA, try not to have a guest the next week. But this is an exception because when I saw that, it immediately brought back memories to when I was in college. I had to do a summer. We all had to do a summer field course. And so it was an entire summer. And we started each day by getting on a bus and going out to the woods or the field or whatever. And there were 3 classes, vertebrates, invertebrates, and botany. And the minute I saw what you do with birds, our professor in the vertebrate part, it was all about birds. And he was one of those who I'm sure, like you, can walk around in the woods, hear a bird song, and identify the bird. And, of course, we had to follow along like a bunch of sheep. And he would point, robin up there or blue jay up there or whatever it is. And then we would learn to listen. I learned a lot, but you lose it. You don't use it, you lose it. And I couldn't do it today if you paid me. But so immediately it all comes back to me, that great summer. We had so much fun at college because we weren't sitting in lecture halls looking at PowerPoints all the time. And how did you get to that point? Because, wow, what a great thing. Yeah.
Yes. I can appreciate what you say because when I started biology in college, I knew I wanted to work with animals and study animals instead of like microscopic things. I never, identify too much with that. But I knew I wanted to study animals, but I didn't know which group. I wasn't sure. I started doing internship on a like shrimp lab, I think. Yeah. And then I started doing internship on the ornithology lab in the university. I was an undergrad. And then when I went to the field for the first time with them, I witnessed both my advisor and other students of his identifying the birds by ear in the field. And it was like, oh my God, I want to do that too. So, and then I studied really hard to be able to identify the birds for that area we were going. And then eventually I was able to identify many of the birds of that area, but then we would, mist net, which is like how we sample the bird community too. So we deploy a net to capture the birds, but then we free them after just to register. And then I wouldn't know how to identify them by eye because I studied so hard the song that I was like, some of them I didn't know when I saw them, but I know the song. I knew the song. So yeah, I always, after that, it was just, I knew I wanted to work with birds and sound.
Oh, that's great. So you were speak bird speak, so I can tell which bird it is, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. So what is it about learning the sounds? It just fascinates you, or I mean, what is it that makes you go that route? What attracted you?
Well, it's just because it's an identity of the bird. You know, it's mm-hmm. something that it's. The song, so for birds, we say songs and calls, basically for the vocal sounds they produce. So when we say song, we are usually talking about the most characteristic vocalization they have, which is usually a longer and in some birds, more melodic song. So these types of vocalizations, they're really characteristic for each species. So we can identify all of them by the songs, which is great. Calls are usually simpler and shorter sounds they produce to communicate. All females produce calls, but not all females produce songs, which is usually the male trying to either, you know, courtship, do some courtship, or conquer territories or fight for territories. So yeah, I think it's amazing, and you don't have to see the bird. But at the same time, when you hear the song or the calls, because we can also identify some birds by the call, we know what we are listening to. So the image comes to us same way. So I think it's incredible too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So how far have you taken this research? What have you done with it?
So I started working with bird sound as an undergrad. The professor back then, he wasn't working with sound. He works more with other ecology research, type of research and anatomy of birds. But he wanted to start working with sounds. That was back in 2010. And then he said, well, why don't you try? So I was sort of like, okay, I want to, let's go. And then I, started to work with bird sound, but my professor was new in the area as well, so we were sort of both learning together. And I first started working with geographical variation of in bird song for the same species. So basically, we checked if across the distribution if there are any variations in the song. So we would gather. Songs and files, sound files from online archives such as Xenocanto or Macaulay Library, and we would use those files to make these comparisons.
Okay.
Yeah, I wondered about that because it's like I wondered if I mean like a cardinal makes a sound and it's very distinct, but is it slightly different in a different region of the country, or is it the same bird song?
Yes, it can vary a lot. So basically for passerine birds, which are like cardinals, a passerine bird, those two are separated between called Austin birds and subaustin birds. So the main difference between those two groups of passerine birds is that Austin birds, they depend a lot on learning from their parents and other adult birds. So if they don't hear their parents and other adult birds, they won't develop their song. On the other hand, Suboxone birds, they have most of the development of their song innate. So if they don't hear their parents or any adult birds, they will develop the song. So when you have an innate song, we expect that there's not going to be a lot of variation because it's innate. However, if we observe some variations between Suboxone birds, it might transfer this information to another level, which is genetic. So if there's a difference in song, might there be a difference in genetics as well? So, and that raises a question if that subspecies is not actually a subspecies, but a different species. Mm-hmm. Whereas passerine birds that depend on learning, we expect some variation to occur because they might accumulate variations when they're learning. So like small variations, and these accumulations might, you know, create dialects, which we call. So passerine birds that depend on learning will have dialects, and they'll still be the same species, and the song might vary a lot, and it doesn't mean anything, not anything, but it doesn't mean that they're different species.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Okay, yeah. So no different than humans, where we have different dialects for different parts of the country or what? Wow, I did not know this. That's so cool. So then there's a real challenge if you're going to say, you know, just cardinal, for instance. So a cardinal from the West Coast versus a cardinal from the East Coast, enough variation. I mean, I'm just making this up, but enough variation that you're really learning two different songs then, if you're doing.
Yes. You know, we usually, like for a cardinal, it's not just about the notes and the pattern, but how they sound. Like they actually, they're... their pitch. So it's very characteristic for a cardinal. So the notes might vary, and usually the most distant they are, like the populations of the same species, more different and diverse the song will be. So yes, but cardinal, even individuals in the same area, they vary a lot because they have different types of notes that they might vary and include on the song.
Mm-hmm. See, if I'd known that, I'd have gotten an A in the course. I got an A anyway, but
oh, that's great.
Oh, good, good.
But see, that there's the problem. See, that's why I struggled. No. So then you're doing all this work and you're recording all these things. Are you accumulating these in some kind of a database or something for study and mapping them, or what are we doing?
Yeah, so I started working with song variation, and I did that for my master's as well. And then for my PhD, I finished my PhD in 2020, and I work with a difference. I studied in a community if birds that sing in similar frequency, meaning similar pitch, would avoid singing together, so they won't overlap and... Huh. Like interfere in the communication. So that's what I studied on my PhD. And then finished my PhD was when I start embroidering, which we'll talk soon. But after I was hired to work as a consultant in the Amazon forest, which is what I still do. So I go to the Amazon forest and I do field work there. I go and I record birds both actively with my own recording equipment and with automatic recorders. So we deploy them and they keep recording for a number of hours. And I also survey the birds. So I would go there and do the list of what birds are there right now. And in the Amazon forest, we really have to rely on vocal and to be able to ID the birds by ear because we don't see anything because it's so dense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I do right now. And when I'm not in the field like now, I am doing annotation, which means I'm hearing what we recorded in the automatic recorders, and I am labeling them. So on the software we use, so and that's another form of sampling the bird community there.
Wow, I want to do your job. Wow.
Well, it's tiring, but it's rewarding for sure. I do like going there and working with those birds for sure.
Yeah. So 2020, you finish your PhD, and then the pandemic hits, and embroidery gets into the mix here.
Which yes.
So what, just looking for something to do or what?
Yeah, I always liked art. I wanted to work on an art project involving birds. And I had applied for some jobs as soon as I finished my PhD, but everything stopped for a moment. So, because of the pandemic. So I was locked in. So I always admired like embroidery art, especially more vintage embroidery, and embroidered clothes. So I was browsing on the internet and I saw an online course, and the final project was a bird, an European, robin. So I said, well, I'm going to try this because I always wanted to learn how to embroider and this type of any, you know, thread art. And this final project is a bird, so I'll go with that. And I really identified myself with this technique and in a way I never have identified with any other art form. So yes, so in 2020, after I finished my PhD, a couple of months after, was when I started embroidering I took the course and then kept on embroidering because I have so many birders and ornithologists friends who instantly started commissioning, even though my first embroidery pieces weren't like, you know, great. I mean, now I compare both like the ones that I did and the ones that I do, and I can see many flaws, but of course it's a process.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, the comparison picture of the gray-headed toady flycatcher that's in the article. Holy smokes, you learn fast. That first bird was, you know, kind of chunky and whatever, but man, the second time, yeah, you really advanced fast. So quick learner or just an awful lot of stitching that just went in the drawer somewhere?
Yeah, I honestly feel like I learned quick, especially because I didn't learn quick other forms of art. I still struggle with watercolor and other art types, but I did practice a lot too.
Yeah, so well, it shows. Yeah,
right.
That first one, it was my first embroidery that I did after the final project of the online course. So I did that bird to see if I could develop a pattern and decide the colors for myself, because of course in the course they give you everything. They give you the colors, they say where the colors go, what you should do. And then that toady flycatcher was the first one that I developed everything.
Okay, so all right, so this also helps because we've talked many times about people figuring out their own colors for a project. So you didn't have a choice, because you didn't have somebody to put together a kit for every bird on the planet. So you had to figure it out. So is that what DMC floss, just buy a bunch of colors and figure it out?
Well, I first started with the colors for the project. And then I had those, I think it were like 30-something colors.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started buying colors from the next bird that I decided to embroider. And so I kept increasing my collection. But after a while, your mind gets used to the numbers and the colors. So now when I have to embroider something, I look at a photo, the numbers already come to my mind, which color I should use for some like colors that I use frequently, like grays, for example. So yeah, it's a matter of keep embroidering and keep. So I was using the color chart from the internet because I wasn't buying the colors myself. I was just ordering online because I was isolating with my parents. And that was a challenge because the colors on the color chart are not accurate to what they really are. Like the little squares, they're usually so different.
Let's clarify first. You were isolating with your parents. Was that the problem or?
I couldn't go out to buy anything because we were really strict, like not because of the pandemic. Yeah, so I ordered everything online, or I called the place so they would deliver it to me.
Yeah.
And you can access, like, and in Brazil, we don't have DMC too much. We do have it, but it's more rare and more expensive than Anchor. Is that what the other Anchor, which is the other brand. So in Brazil, it's mostly Anchor in all of the craft store and everything. So you can find an Anchor or a DMC color chart on the internet, which you can see the little rectangles with the color and the number. But most of the times they translate so bad to the actual color. And I don't think it's anybody's fault. It's probably very difficult to just, you know, put in one square a flat thing, and thread is not, you know, it's not a flat color. It's just a thread has a texture, you know. So the thing that I learned that is best to know the colors when you can't go to buy is search for the actual photo, the photo of this on the internet. So what do you call this whole thing?
Skein.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So you search for the skein color, the skein image. So you see this, a picture of this on Google, and then that would be the best translation to the actual color. And that's how I started to get to know more of the colors without being in touch with them personally before buying them. That's how I find it's the most productive way to know a color if you can't go and buy. Now I go and I see myself and I bring a picture of the bird and, you know. But yeah, and that, yes, now I'm more used to the colors, and especially for the beak of the bird, which is usually gray. I just looking at photos, I can tell the grays that I'm using because they're not many gray shades. And you get used to the colors. And another thing that I was going to comment about colors is I do the type of stitch I do is called needle painting or thread painting, which is the techniques is similar to painting. And I use only one strand out of the six that comes in each one. So you can do needle painting with six strands, but I usually do with only one to make it more realistic and more subtle, the color transitions. And if you see the color here, it's going to be one thing. If you see in one strand, it's going to be another thing. And if you see the strand in the fabric, because of the contrast of the strand with the fabric and the other colors you already used, is another thing. So these are all things that it's a matter of practice. You can't just learn from one day to another. You have to get used to it.
So did you have to do a lot of ripping out when you first started? Did you do a lot of frogging, as we call it, taking out and starting again?
When I first started, I still do. I will rip it out until I get it right. And I think it's great about embroidery. I mean, if you do many times, you might get the fabric weak and like loose, and it's not great if you redo it many times, but I think it's great that I can just cut it and start it over. Like, I can't do this in painting. So painting is like usually get me more nervous and anxious because just if you can ruin everything.
Well, there's always white paint, though. That's the thing, is what I learned. If you're doing acrylic, you can just cover it with white paint. That also works, so you know.
I was interested when that you start with the eye and the beak, because when I was taught photography and it came to animal photography, rule number one is get that eye in focus. No matter what else happens in the image, get the eye in focus and your mind will accept the image. Even if it's horrible, it'll accept the image. But if that eye's blurred, it simply doesn't work. So you are applying that same principle to the eye and the beak. You start with that and get it right and then go from there.
Yes, I always start with the eye because I really like to get a nice look, because at the end of the when you finish the whole piece, the eye will still grab your attention. So, and if you leave the eye to do last, everything around it will be embroidered. So for you to cut it and start it over would be a little more challenging. So I always like to start with the eye and get that right. So if I don't get it right at first, I can redo it calmly and start over until I get it right. So, and I usually do a back stitch or, back stitch to do the outline of the circle. And then I'll do the pupil and around it and the highlights, which is very important to get a good highlight.
Is there a lot of difference between bird eyes, or are they all pretty much the same black circle?
No, they vary a lot. They have many, there are many colors, eye colors, and even on the same species, usually birds with the color vary in age too. Like the eye can be darker and or lighter depending on age. But among species, yeah, there are all sorts of eye colors for birds. Brighter.
Okay, so that's not an automatic thing then.
No, and to put highlights is, it's will vary with that too, because if the eyes like straight, like no eyes is entirely black, but some of them will look entirely black. And then for you to put the highlight, you have to sort of build your way up to the white, not just put white, but rather a gray layer and then apply the whites after. So it's not like, you want it to be realistic. So to acquire a glassy feature, it's important to build this highlight, putting other layers of gray before achieving the white part, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. Now, when you do this, are you trying to do scientific illustration level, like Audubon level? Or, I mean, are you trying to be that accurate, or are you taking some artistic license with these?
I try to be as accurate as possible. I don't usually take, I've embroidered once that was from a cartoon that my friend asked, but apart from that, I usually try to use a combination of photos to translate the bird coloration and morphology the best that I can. And, like the beak is it's the most challenging part for me, because you usually sketch the beak, or you do the outline from a photo and it's going to be one thing. And then as soon as you start embroidering, because the thread has, a thickness, it will become a little different. So what I do for beaks is always to make an outline a little thinner than it actually is. So when I embroider, it will achieve the actual thickness or size.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah, I try to be. I want to do scientific embroidery for sure. That's what I aim every time I do a bird. But it's difficult. I will accept if someone says that my embroideries are not perfect, and because it's very difficult.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I can imagine to get every feather, every striation, every, subtle shade change has got to be well, I'm sure it's difficult for someone who does it with colored pencil or watercolor.
Yes.
It's just got to be hard no matter what, especially with birds, with all the colors that they have. And with your Amazon work, I mean, I'm sure the colors just get crazy with those birds. Yeah. And, that's got to be kind of a long-term challenge to get to a point where you're really satisfied with what you do. What we saw in the pictures is impressive in its own right, but I'm sure that from your perspective, it's, but I can do a little more here and a little more there. Yeah.
Yes. I feel like I learn new stuff every time I embroider a new bird. And, it's great because I also learn about a lot about the actual bird, many birds that people, commission or that I had to embroider for a certain project or, for any other reason, I always ended up learning something about the bird because I have to really pay attention to the photos. And, I usually try to embroider the colors on a neutral light, and not too sunny, not too shadowy. So yes, it's a very good process to really get immersed on a bird and learn all sorts of details about it.
Yeah. So take us through that process. Half dozen photos, different angles to start, and then you start sketching on a piece of paper. How do you go about that?
From when I used to do commissions a lot, many people would ask for an embroidery of a photo they've taken of a bird.
Okay.
So in those cases, I don't have much freedom to change anything. So I would just get the outline from the photos, like straight out of the photo. And which I also did when they didn't require out of a photo. So for that, I could use a free licensed photo of a bird to get the outline. Or I would sketch a little to get a position that is not found for that bird. Or to demonstrate something else, I would use photos of a similar species that has a very similar body, and then incorporate the colors of the species that I want in that design. And then I always do this outline either from a photo of or the sketching I do on a parchment paper to transfer to the fabric. So my method of transferring the pattern to the fabric is just putting the parchment paper against the facing the fabric, the part with the 2B. I usually do the outline with a very transferable type of pencil. So I can just face the parchment paper in the fabric and put some tape around it. And I would use usually my scissors to do this and really transfer the graffiti pattern to the fabric. And then I would finish the details with a pen that will go away with heat. So it's not okay. not very practical, but it's the method that I started doing first. So I still do it. I don't like transferring on a light table or the window. I never got used to doing this too much. So I keep doing the transfer like this.
Hey, whatever works, whatever works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
What is your typical ground cloth? Are you locked in on one type of ground cloth?
So in Brazil, we have a type of cloth that we called cotton. The literal translation would be raw cotton. And it's very similar to a Canva fabric, but not as thick, I would say. So I couldn't find this. This time I forgot my fabric in Brazil, so I had to go and buy some. And I had some trouble because they didn't know what I was talking about. And I tried to explain, I forgot to bring an embroidery of mine, so that was my mistake. But then I ended up buying like a cotton, I think, fabric, which is thinner than what I usually go for, but it worked because I had to embroider a bird which I haven't posted yet to someone here. So it's working pretty well, even though it's a little thinner than I'm used to. And I'm trying to remember the name of the brand. It's
is it Kona?
I think so. Yeah, Kona maybe. Yeah, they have all sorts of colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's Kona cotton. Yeah, it's a nice quilting cotton. People use it a lot for quilting, but it's, I don't know. It's not the same as like what we got.
Beth and I just
the calico.
Beth and I just went through this thing. Yep, we got on a show. Jessica Grimm from Bavaria sent us some calico cloth that they get in Europe that we just simply can't get here. That is heavy, heavy duty, sturdy cloth that you can really put some weight to, and I bet that's what
that's
the same
probably
thing.
What I use.
And we just can't get it here. They don't have anything similar here in the United States.
It's such a difference. Yeah. So I bet you'll never forget your cloth again, right?
Well, I actually like this one, but it's different. What I might do is just put two, because even if I tighten the hoop a lot, sometimes it would keep like getting like loose at some points, and I have to keep like tightening it up. So maybe using two layers would help. But for this embroidery right now, it worked perfectly. For the one that I did before that, it was a little trickier because this issue kept happening. But yeah. I went to an art supply store in Rochester last week, and I saw that they sell Canva fabric. And that one really reminded me of the one we use in Brazil, which is this raw cotton. So mm-hmm. I was wondering if I could try this other Canva sometime. But I still have this Kona fabric here. So
Now I'm curious. Now I want to go to an art store and see what that is.
They keep like on a roll, just like people sell fabric, and Joanne's fabric,
just a big bolt.
So they had all sorts of thickness of canvas, so I thought that might work. I mean, I'm sure it works, but it was certainly interesting to see, and the texture seems similar as well, and the colors, because Kona is very, like, it's one color. You can't see variation. The cotton that I use, you can almost see the holes a little bit better. Mm. Like,
mm-hmm. Right. That's very tight. The Kona is a very tight weave.
Yeah.
Very, very tight weave. Right. Yeah. So interesting.
Yep.
Yep.
Now it makes me curious. I've got to, okay. I mean, might have to make a Dick Blick run.
Yeah. Gotta see. Yeah. Yeah. So what was the needle painting technique? Did it come naturally to you? Because for a lot of people, it's just a frightening thing to even think about doing. Did it kind of come natural to you, or was it kind of a struggle to get shading to give the right look?
Well, I think one thing that worked in my favor is that I didn't know anything about embroidery before starting. So I wasn't afraid of anything. I mean, I thought it was just a style. But now after I got into the embroidery world, and I know how scary it is. And I think it's scary because it's such a free technique. Like, even I know many people who do needle painting, and even we're applying the same technique, each one has their signature, so it's very different. Because you have the freedom to decide the size of the stitches and how you do the color, how can I say, the color
shading,
not just the shading, but
the blending.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So the color blending is very distinct between artists. And of course, the color selection too. So, I would see some embroidery artists that would choose like really brighter colors, even though the subject might not be as bright, and which is fine, but it's just a style that people get more used to. So I think people usually fear needle painting because you have to rely a lot on your decisions, and it's not just like, oh, this is very like cross stitch, and I love cross stitch. I think it's amazing, and I only did it like a couple of times, but it's usually like you have a pattern, you have to apply cross stitch here and fill those squares, and it's very, you know, you really rely on the technique you learn. And but for needle painting, you have to take decisions, and it becomes more of how you deal with each challenge on each subject you're embroidering. But yes, I thought it was great because it was I didn't need to learn like specific. Like, oh, I have to do a knot here and come down this way and then go down this way. So I thought it was felt great when I started.
So did you already have had you taken art classes when you were younger? Because I think what frightens me more about thread painting is the shading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did take classes, and I also took classes of nature drawing, and during my biology under graduation, and I also took an online course for scientific drawing or something. And yeah, I think the classes definitely helped, and also observing many, many photos, bird photos in my case, but it would be any photos of anything you're studying to do it. Now I'm embroidering a bird that the photo that I picked for position, the shade, the light was coming from below, so it's kind of awkward. So it's very bright down here, and it's darker on the upper parts of the bird and back, which is, I usually don't do that. I usually embroider like with light on the head and the beak and shadow below. So I used a photo for a position, but I created a different, I just inverted the shadow and lightning patterns for this bird that I'm doing. So I did bright in the head, and I did shadow below, and so I basically inverted. It becomes easier after you do with everything. I feel like all my answers is like, well, becomes easier after you do many, many times, but it's true. It becomes more natural after you repetition.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I think that's the only way to get good at something, as good as you've gotten. I think it is. It shows that you took time to practice and to do the work. And that's great. It's beautiful. It's beautiful work.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it really is. And then you put the spectra, whatever of the songs and the sounds, you stitch that in. It's kind of a nice little touch that that you do that. Just because you know the songs, so do you, when you stitch them and then go back, do you recognize the song? Which is kind of a dumb question, I guess, but I don't know. It's just an interesting addition to a piece of embroidery to put that in there.
Yes, I had this idea. I think the first one that I did was for a Kiskadee in Brazil, but then the official one, the first like big piece with the sonogram and waveform, was a bell bird, which is the birds that sing the loudest singers in the world. And I thought, I'm going to include the sonogram in this one. And what happened, so there are two graphs that I include. The first one is the waveform, which translates to amplitude throughout time. So it's how loud the song is throughout time. So it's only talking about if it's loud or quieter, this specific graph. But below, I embroidered a sonogram, which the x-axis is the same, which is time. However, the y-axis is pitch. So it highly pitched or like lower pitched the bird sings. So a sonogram, really, it's an image of sound. So if you get used to reading sonograms and looking at those images, you can understand what's going on looking at the sonogram. I'm not going to say I can't sing the song by looking at the sonogram, but if you listen to the song and you see the sonogram, it makes sense, because it's how low and how high in pitch the song occurs throughout time. So I really like to add this to the pieces, because it's a stamp of their song. It's an image of the song, you know.
Sure.
And yes, after I have so much fun doing the sonograms, because I usually do them after I finish the bird, which is the tense part. So after I finish the bird, it's so much fun to do the sonogram, and I love doing those.
Yeah, it's a nice touch. Now, when you say North American birds and then you get tropical birds, is that kind of a shock to your system with the brighter colors? It must be a real adjustment mentally.
With thread
colors, to start working with a completely different palette, I would guess, for a lot of birds.
But not much, because when you start taking commissions, you start getting all like birds that are not necessarily bright and beautiful, but they mean something to people. So even regarding, I did, most of my birds are Brazilian birds that occur in Brazil. So, but even then I had a lot of commissions for birds that are not necessarily bright and colorful, but they just have some meaning for whoever asked for that embroidery. So yeah, I think it's certainly color, very bright, colorful birds that have distinct parts in the body is usually easier to do, because it's sort of straightforward. You look at the colors, the thread colors, you sort of know where you're going. But when it's a bird that is like pale or some dusty tones, it's, you have to sit down and think more, because it's more subtle transitions.
Yeah. Because the one that stood out for me, I forget where I saw it, Instagram or wherever, but it was the starling, and you were going to put the white dots in, and I thought, oh boy, that's got to be that's got to be hard.
Yeah.
The white dots were actually okay. I mean, I even though we say white dots, they're like there were like more than 7 different colors of light to lighter shades.
Yeah.
So you can make the differences between the, but I actually have a lot of fun with birds that I have to embroider the base color of the body and then include the dots. That's usually how I do. There are people who embroider everything and they leave the space for the dots, but I just embroider over it, because I think for me it works better this way. But I there are people who actually leave the space in the fabric to embroider the spots later. But yes, the starling was a fun one to embroider those spots. But it was challenging to decide some of the colors of the body, because it's such an iridescent color.
Yeah.
And it changes, and each photo it looks different.
Yeah. No. If people starlings are one of those that if you take the time to really watch them, and the light reflecting off those feathers, they're really quite beautiful. Where most people will go, oh, that's just a black bird with white spots. But, you know, there's an awful lot going on there that if you just take a moment to watch it,
Yes.
So,
and
so
many people don't like them. Poor birds.
No. I know, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what'd they do? What'd they do to people?
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. So where are you headed? Where are you going with this? Are you looking to develop some classes to teach others, or are you just enjoying stitching these birds and collecting them? Yeah, we got an exhibition coming up. Where are you headed?
Well, I would love to have an exhibition coming up, but I don't right now. I do have e-books teaching, like step-by-step to embroider some species. And I would like to do that in English as well. I only have it in Portuguese and have material to sell for people who don't speak Portuguese. But for now, I my main work is as a biologist. So I'm still working most of my time with bird sound. But I do workshops occasionally, and I take some commissions occasionally, and I'm in US because my partner lives here, so we're sort of here and in Brazil, so he goes down there and then I come here. So the plan is eventually move here to US, and then I want to work more with embroidery and do other works around that involves art and science. And I've been very happy with some opportunities that I had here in US with embroidery. So I have a piece in the birds, the Cornell magazine that I was 2 years ago. So it was pretty good, pretty amazing experience. And then, there's the fall edition of the Audubon magazine that's going to be out this fall. And I also had, a piece about my work there, and then EGA. So these were all amazing experiences, and of course, now today too, doing the podcast. I mean, I was talking about the magazines, but, and I've been invited to so many great things, and I would love eventually when I move here for, more steadily to keep working with, embroidery somehow and involving science.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. To get a piece in the Audubon, holy smokes. That's impressive. That's great.
Yeah.
Yes, I was very, very happy when they contacted me and they wanted to do the piece. So someone came here in Ithaca, photographer, to take pictures of me and the piece. So I haven't posted the piece that I did for them yet. And but I'm very, very happy with all the opportunities that I've been giving and sharing my work.
Yeah. And we should give credit that the university, you're at Cornell, right? Your work?
I do work for them, but it's nothing related to embroidery or, I annotate for them too, but it's just, this is like a specific work on contract. So.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Cause it's a Macaulay. Is it?
Yes. It's for what I do. I do annotation for, Merlin. So for, you know, Merlin, the app that identified birds.
No, I don't know that one.
Hmm. Merlin. No. Yeah. There are two apps from Cornell, Merlin and BirdNet. So it's an app that will identify the sounds of the birds, like a Shazam, but for birds.
Yeah.
Still, so for this app to work, they have people identifying the birds and training the machine. So I do work for that bit, but it's just contract work. It's not my main work. And I would do this work when I have the time to do that. So it's not something specific. Yeah.
Oh, now there's a fun app. I got to get this now. So I can literally walk around and do, like, Shazam is amazing with music. It's incredible what it'll do. So I
yes,
do the same
and especially
thing.
In North America, it's really widespread and, it can ID many species. I mean, for some places, of course, they're still training the app, you know, so yeah. But for North America, especially with more common birds that you would hear next to your place or in a park, I'm pretty sure you can identify everything.
Oh, got to check that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
It IDs photos too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Boy. Okay. That's going to be fun. Yep. Got to get that. Well, Anna, most impressive work and in such a short time. Wow. Mm-hmm. The progress you've made from scratch to what you do now is really stunning.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Really good. Yep. Well, thanks so much for the time. And we'll look forward to what you learn and experience when you head south and spend time in the Amazon again. That's got to be, that'd be fun. Really great fun. So thanks for making time with us, and we appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me and having me here today. It was great. It was great meeting the two of you, and I look forward to seeing it next week. Hopefully I didn't do many bloopers or anything.
No, we're fine. All right, thanks.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much. Bye.